Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 22nd, 2006. Our session today is entitled Leaving Home to Find Home, A Pilgrimage with Jacob. Our presenter is Richard Prigge, session number PRR2006-02. Let's listen in.
As I said in my prayer, walking alongside Rebecca and Jacob and the rest of their family to learn what it means to grow spiritually. There's no question that Rebecca is the star of the story and the beginning of this story, and we're going to be with her most all of today. And then the action's going to shift to focus on Jacob more in the 3 days that we have ahead. So I think for those of you who were not here yesterday, and also for those who were here, we might summarize yesterday by saying that we learned a little bit from Rebecca about how important hospitality is as a spiritual virtue. The willingness to welcome strange and new people, and also the willingness to welcome new developments in life hospitably. Rather than to reject them, saying no, that's too foreign to me. I'm not going there. Rebecca's a model of hospitality to us and shows us how important that is as a spiritual virtue. She's also willing to leave home quite suddenly, and thereby I think shows us how important it is to be willing to leave home in order to find home, in God. And again, as we said yesterday, that means not just physically or geographically leaving home, but spiritually leaving home and being willing to develop one's own identity and relationship with God. We also saw how some comparatively minor characters in the story can be actually pretty important. And I'd argue, I guess, that in any good story, that's true, that you have the major characters and you have more minor characters, but some of the minor characters can really be important. How about Abraham's servant as a really important, quote, minor character? I mean, I realized as I went back to my room yesterday and I thought, boy, you know, it wasn't Abraham who thought of this way of finding Rebecca. It was the servant who settled upon hospitality as the real kind of touchstone for finding a wife for Isaac. So that was pretty spiritually intuitive there on his part. He was also incredibly loyal. Any of us would just love to have a friend or co-worker as loyal as Abraham's servant. So we're already discovering some real just important stuff here about what it means to grow in God. Today, let's start with the Genesis 25. So we've got Isaac married here. Isaac and Rebecca are married. Now let's see what happens to them once they're married. We've got Genesis 25, verses 19 through 34. This is going to be the story of the birth of Esau and Jacob. This is pretty obvious, I guess, to say this, but we're dealing with a birth story. Okay, and we've already talked about the moment of leaving home as kind of a spiritually important moment. How about the moment of birth? Is a very spiritually laden moment. And if we had time, we might even kind of invite you to tell birth stories here. I mean, the time of the birth of a child is very spiritually laden, I think. So that's what the moment that we're, you might think of the birth, your own birth, the stories that your parents have told you about your own birth, or the birth of your children, just important moments. So we're reading a birth story, Genesis 25, 19 through 34, and we're going to move very quickly from birth to adolescence. So I need two readers. Okay, thank you. Would you remind me of your name?
Kate.
Kate, Anna's sister.
Anna's sister.
I know. How do you like to be identified that way? Anna's sister.
My little sister gets identified as Kate's sister all the time. So
all right, okay, Kate's got one. You've got verses 19 through 26, Kate. And who else will read? Ruth will read 27 through 34. Okay? 19 to 26 and 27 to 34.
Launch him. And Isaac here. This is the account of Abraham's son Isaac. Abraham gave the father of Isaac, and Abraham became the father of Isaac. And Isaac, when Isaac was 40 years old, Abraham became the father of Isaac. And Isaac was 40 years old when he married Rebekah, daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean from Paddan Aram, and sister of Laban, an Aramean. Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife, because she was barren. The Lord answered his prayer, and his wife Rebekah became pregnant. The babies jostled inside in her, and she said, "Why is this happening to me?" So she went to inquire of the Lord. The Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you will be separated. One person will be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger." When the time came for her to give birth, there were twin boys in her womb. The first came out was red, and his whole body was like a hairy garment, so she named him Esau. After this, his brother came out, with his hand grasping Esau's heel, so he was called Jacob. Isaac was 6 years old when Rebekah gave birth to them.
When the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man, living in tents. Isaac loved Esau because he was fond of game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Once, when Jacob was cooking a stew, Esau came in from the field, and he was famished. Esau said to Jacob, "Let me eat some of that red stuff, for I am famished." Therefore, he was called Edom. Jacob said, "First, sell me your birthright." Esau said, "I am about to die. Of what use is a birthright to me?" Jacob said, "Swear to me first." So he swore to him and swore his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went away. Thus Esau despised his birthright.
Okay. Okay, what strikes you? This is going to be our pattern, by the way, all week. We're going to read and then we're going to go to what strikes you. That's great. Something that you find outstanding, something exciting, something puzzling.
I hadn't realized that Isaac was so old when he married Rebekah. We spoke yesterday that she was probably a teenager, and he says here he's 40 years old.
Yeah, he's 40, he's 61, so they have 20 years of childlessness. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You think it's strange that Abraham didn't send someone earlier to get him a wife before Isaac was 40?
I don't know.
It just seems kind of strange to me.
Okay. Go for it.
I was going to throw out little bits of possible explanations.
Okay.
For it. So I'm unfortunately just finished my first year in seminary, so I know just enough knowledge to make me know anything. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but in a lot of the Hebrew scriptures, 40 is just a representative of like the fullness of time, basically. So like the 40 years that they were wandering the wilderness. Mm-hmm.
40 days and 40 nights.
Mm-hmm.
Right, as a flood and 40, yeah, all of these, the sign of 40 just means like...
A long time.
Right, long time. It's
and
not necessarily
the time of
40.
Testing. Yeah.
Time of testing, time of completion.
Yeah.
Time, I've heard it referred to as the fullness of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it may not have been that Isaac was actually 40 is really old for someone.
Yeah.
So 40 may seem old to us, but it's actually...
But maybe to the people reading it, they're like, ah, he's come to...
It's time for him to have a wife.
Right.
Very cool. That's
time has come.
That's terrific. Terrific.
Thank you. I'm struck also that Rebecca was barren like Sarah. They named that. So they prayed to God she was barren. And that's just like Isaac's mother.
What is it about barrenness? Sarah, Rebecca... Rachel is going to have trouble bearing children. Hannah, the mother of Samuel. Elizabeth, the wife of Zechariah. What is
God's
it about?
Involved.
Pardon me?
God's involved to get the process going.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
There's guilt there.
There's what?
There's guilt there. I think a lot of guilt. It's all on her. It's not on him at all.
Yeah, okay.
But they could have had a low sperm count.
That's right. I don't remember reading that.
You never hear Rebecca pray to the Lord for a higher sperm count.
What is this? Instead it says she was barren. I mean, what a thing to say.
Yeah.
Well, I think that bit about God is necessary, you know, that could be important here. It certainly is clear that for all of the important most of the important characters, there was difficulty giving birth rather than something very easy.
And I think it just emphasizes that it's a gift from God.
Okay, good.
Does it also limit the number of offspring? If they otherwise had 10 kids, would these two be as significant as they are?
That's interesting. I never thought of that, but can you remember any, quote, barren woman who then had loads of offspring? I don't think I can. Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, Hannah, Elizabeth, none of them had a whole lot, did they? Can you think?
It brings into sharp relief the covenant thing about you'll have as many offspring as the stars in the sky and sand.
Yeah.
It's a real contrast with having an iron.
Isn't it? It's not until Jacob that we start seeing, oh yeah, there could be a lot of offspring here. I mean, Jacob ends up having 12 sons, but they're not from his favorite. Rachel only has two, you're right. So that's very, very interesting. Quite interesting. Yeah, we'll go Cliff and then...
John the Baptist was among the child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's Elizabeth. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Elizabeth and Zechariah. Right. That's exactly right. Yeah.
I'm struck with and curious also, you know, she finally gets her wish, I'm sure, to have a child, and then there's all this struggle going on within inside of her.
Yeah.
And it says, so she went to inquire of the Lord and then gets an answer.
Okay.
So where did she went to? I mean, so she went, is that an internal prayer thing? Did she go seeking an oracle? And so often in the scriptures, it seems so simple. So the person goes and makes an inquiry and God says, and it makes it sound so simple here, but I'm assuming it probably wasn't.
Yeah, okay, that's, I think, a critically important part of this story, so let's just say that for just a second and finish with this business of, quote, barrenness and difficulty giving birth. I mean, is that speaking to you at all? I mean, let's take this in a spiritual way and not just literally having biological children. But in terms of giving birth to that which is really, really important and significant in your life, I mean, is that often problematic and difficult and happen over time? Or, you know, is that the type of thing, you know, wow, just bingo, happens and it's all easy and we're all smiling and happy and, well, I think I'm answering my own question. I mean, isn't it true that...
Well, she gets more than she bargained for, too. She gets twins,
yeah.
You know, in the first place, and then there's some sort of contentiousness going on that's troubling her.
Right.
So there's this gift brings a problem as well.
It sure does.
She knows that from before the time you're born.
Yeah. Gifts bring problems in this story in life. I mean, the great gift of the birthright here and the blessing. Whoa, what a wonderful gift, right? Nothing but trouble for Jacob. So So yeah, there's struggle. Struggle is part of the spiritual life. I mean, and if you're in the midst of it, remember that you heard it here. Let's see. I want to pursue the translation that Kate had for verse 22. Could the rest of you please look at verse 22? The children struggled together within her, and Kate, and she said, what in your version?
Why is this happening to me?
Anyone else have anything else?
If it is to be this way, why do I live?
Whoa. Wow. Is there a little difference there between those two things? What's the difference?
Well, she's obviously desperate.
Absolutely.
Obviously desperate.
In my version, it's very like, oh no, something's going on.
What's going on?
It sounds, I don't think she's in that much pain. But she's not
desperate. Desperate. Any other words other than desperate?
Yeah. Are you in 22?
Yes.
In the American, American translation, which is conservative Missouri Synod oriented, it says,
to be precise,
she said, if it's like this, what am I here for?
Okay.
She went to ask the Lord.
Okay, are we, other words other than desperate? What am I here
for? Angry.
Angry?
Okay, yes.
Yeah. Angry. Yeah, okay.
I have to go through this.
How about depressed?
No.
Yeah. No?
Yeah. Frustrated.
Okay.
Okay.
There's a footnote in my Bible that says, meaning of the Hebrew, uncertain. But there is definitely some desperation here. And so then we're going to, I always think in the Bible there's some places where there's like a lot in between the lines that I sure would like to know. I mean, now on to your question, Cliff. I mean, because it goes so quickly. If it is to be this way, why do I live? So she went to inquire of the Lord. This is absolutely key. Yeah, go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, I just, you know, I was thinking, when I first heard it, you know, read it, it was just like, okay, well, it's this particular situation, but then suddenly it's expanding out, and you're picturing in your mind, she has made a big step here to move to this land with Isaac, and so it's almost like she may be asking the bigger question, like, you know, if this is all part of God's will, you know, it's like that, everybody goes through that, you know, hit that wall and you just say, did I get off on the wrong road here?
Maybe this was a terribly bad choice after all.
And again, you know, sometimes you have this feeling like when God has directed you in a certain direction, you feel real strong confidence in that. When you hit that first roadblock, then you start questioning everything. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I get kind of a feeling of sadness, I guess, when I read that just after that it says two nations are in your womb, two people butting heads while still in your body. It seems like Jacob and Esau and Isaac and Ishmael, but every time we get a blessing, we're setting up these terrible, catastrophic, historical situations.
Conflict. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it says, be careful what you wish for, because it was Isaac who requested that she not be barren. She didn't. We don't see where she prayed for it. It was at the very number 20. He was the one who asked the Lord for the baby.
Yes,
for a baby or offspring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There is a sadness here. We're going to have to see how God is at work in that. It's hard to figure out.
Yeah, I just finished rereading a book by Frederick Beekman last night about Tobit on the road with the archangel and the apocryphal story. And the angel Raphael leads Tobit's son Tobias on a journey to restore the family. But throughout it all, Tobit's prayer becomes indicative of the people of Israel seeing God as a great scorekeeper. If you do good and you're holy, then you'll be rewarded. If you sin or do something bad, what your family does, whoa, you're going to get it, and individually and the people. And so, you know, I wonder here then about what's happening in the minds of these characters. I mean, at this point with the struggle, what have, you know, maybe Rebecca saying, what have I done, what sin have I committed, or what's in my past that's the that's leading to this struggle and this potential heartache.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, her instinct to turn to God to make some sense out of this apparently senseless situation is a huge moment in the story. It's huge. And I guess I would want to identify that as another thing that Rebecca has to teach us about a spiritually mature life. That when we come to points in our lives when we just have no way of making sense at all what is happening, that we can turn to God, or as it says here, inquire of the Lord, what's going on? You know, what do you want from me now, God? What is happening here? It's interesting then that the oracle here about the two nations in your womb, that oracle is given to Rebecca and not to Isaac. Mm-hmm. Right? So that is significant here.
You wonder if she told him.
Well, yeah, that's going to be interesting in the next story that we're going to read about the deathbed blessing of Isaac. Yeah.
Would you review for us what the birthright meant?
Yeah, two things. The birthright meant head of the family. Okay, you're at the head of the table, huh, for all decisions. And it meant a double share of the inheritance. So this is huge. This is a huge thing. Now, what about, okay, if we can move on a little bit to that story, what about Jacob and Esau here? How would you describe Esau in this story?
Kind of want to compare them to Cain and Abel a little bit.
How so?
One's the manly,
yeah,
rough hunter, and one is the more gentle farmer.
Mm-hmm. Esau is the jock, and Jacob is the nerd.
Okay. Isaac is an outdoorsman. Jacob is an indoorsman. And we find that in pretty stark relief here. What is Jacob doing when Isaac comes in?
Cooking.
He's cooking.
Yeah.
He's a cook. Okay. What else about Esau?
He gives in to the flesh very, very easily.
Does he?
Well, he's hungry, and just for being hungry, he gives away his birthright.
Okay. Well, maybe he was very, very hungry.
He says,
he's
famished.
To die. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's about to die. Why do we assume that Esau is exaggerating here? I mean, I think all of us tend to think, you idiot. You know, I mean, you can't be that hungry. Sell away your birthright. But why do we assume that? I don't know.
Well, he just came in from the field. It doesn't say he was out on a, you know,
trek
on a journey.
Okay.
He was working.
In the open country.
Okay.
But since he was the man of action, he could have just taken it the other way. Take it. There's some integrity on his part.
All right.
Yeah, I mean, what's the deal with his brother not just giving him the stew? Instead of saying, oh, you're obviously hungry and exhausted, and I've just made a wonderful meal, instead of saying, here, have some. He says, no, sell me your birthright. I mean, I find no fault with Esau in this story. But I'm an oldest child, that's why.
Yeah, can we make a comparison here? I mean, to a modern day, forget the birthright, what would we compare it to? So you're coming in hungry after a hike to Stehekin or whatever, and I've got a bowl of soup. I say, all right, I'll give you a bowl of soup if you'll give me your house and your car. And I mean, how ridiculous would that be?
Not very hospitable.
No, it's the opposite of hospitality.
Opposite of their mother.
It is. It's the opposite of Rebecca, opposite of... Well,
what Rebecca had been.
Yeah. Well, okay.
And how strange that Jacob is the one that Rebecca loves, and yet he has this kind of anti-Rebecca response to his brother.
Okay.
His anti-hospitality.
All right, but now this is going to be very, very significant. So why is Rebecca siding with Jacob?
I think Rebecca's changed.
Oh. How so?
Well, later on, I think she becomes more of the kingmaker, the behind the throne, orchestrating things.
Why?
That I don't know.
Okay. Well.
She has it straight from God that's
absolutely
how it's to be.
Absolutely.
God has told her.
Absolutely. God has told her, and as far as we know in the story, she is the only one who knows this. This has been a private revelation or oracle to Rebecca. And it's a completely countercultural one. But the younger will come out on top.
The elder shall serve the younger.
Yeah. So this is going to be, wow, if that is going to happen, it's going to require a lot of Rebecca. It isn't going to automatically happen. So let's see if we can see that.
Well, just imagine her telling that kind of thing to Jacob as he's growing up.
Huh. Right. Do you think she does?
I don't know.
Well, by what he asked for, I would suspect.
it doesn't really matter. I mean, I think of sibling rivalry, you know, as a way to think of it. And that Jacob came out of the womb already, grabbing his brother's
right
heel.
How'd you like to be named Heel Grabber? Not a real flattering way to go, huh? Yeah, but Jacob, I think we can certainly say here, is opportunistic.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, he seizes the moment to make quite a bargain.
And I don't know if I'm just kind of projecting my own kind of image on them, but, you sort of picture in your mind what these two guys were like, and you sort of picture that Jacob had to live by his wits, and his more cunning, and Esau was probably kind of a little bit of a, not as quick on the draw, so to speak. And so there's this, kind of conflict that's been going on from the womb. I mean, this is just one little story, but, any of us who can think back to those sibling rivalry days or whatever can realize it was always one thing after another. You're always, boom, 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 back and forth, And my brother and I, just came.
Yeah.
And it got just as strange and goofy as selling birthrights at times.
So this is a real human story.
Oh, you're always trying to one-up the other sibling, And you knew their weaknesses, you knew which buttons to push, you knew when they were vulnerable, and you did it, and then they do it back to you,
Yeah. Yeah. Can we just observe then and stop with that? That's just really, really great. And just say that God is at work through all of that? I mean, how strange is that? Don't we often have the idea that God is at work through wonderful things that happen? And, see the mountains up there, and there's God at work, and, all good things happen. So God is at work here through a lot of messiness. I mean, I'm with Kristen's sermon last week, for those of you who are here, the messy room. God is at work through a lot of messy stuff here. A sibling rivalry, cheating the father, tricking the father out of a final blessing. Whoa. Where's that?
I have trouble with that God is causing these bad things.
Oh, no. Well, be careful. I didn't say God is causing them.
You said he's at work. Mm-hmm. But I see that as the same as God bringing good from evil.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
That's
sure.
That's how God's at work.
That's right.
That's work.
Because what is God's intent here in this story? I mean, there's a lot of ways that God is at work, but God is forming a people, and it's going to be through Jacob that it's going to happen.
He's fulfilling his promise that he made.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's messy, but it's a messy, messy story. This is not the way we would have necessarily written it here to happen. Yes, all of
I'm not sure if this is a good question or not, but so Rebecca has this idea. God tells her the elder shall serve the younger, and we're going to upend the usual power structure and all of this. But we also hear that Isaac loved Esau, Rebecca loved Jacob.
Mm-hmm.
The thing, I mean, I'm a parent of kids, you know, who sometimes have their issues. And, I mean, to what extent, and I react to that, one parent loved one kid, the other parent loved the other kid. Whoa, that's a whole other territory. But my question is about, and I don't know if this is an inappropriate question for this text, but is Rebecca trying to do what God wants? Is she trying to bring about this picture that she got when she went and asked God, what the heck's going on inside me? Or is this what she wants because she loved Jacob?
It is self-fulfilling prophecy.
Well, yeah, and nobody's motives are clean and straightforward.
Absolutely.
But is that the same question?
I think that's part. That is a great question. I think that's part of the messiness of the story. And I like. Thank you for your comment, because our own human experience illustrates that we often don't have pure motives. I mean, they're mixed motives. But I think we can discover, actually, in the next story that we're going to go on to, I'm going to move us on to the next story here, to keep your question in mind, okay? What is motivating Rebecca? Is it the oracle that she's received, or just whatever affection, you know, there is between, or favoritism between Rebecca and Jacob? So we're going to move on to chapter 27. We want to keep in mind, though, I think, this instinct of Rebecca's to turn to God to make sense of what seems to be nonsense. That's going to play in here. Chapter 27 is a long story.
Then Isaac trembled exceedingly and said, "Who? Where is the one who hunted game and brought it to me? I ate all of it before he came, and I have blessed him, and indeed he shall be blessed." When Esau heard the words of his father, he cried with an exceedingly great and bitter cry, and said to his father, "Bless me, even me also, O my father." But he said, "Your brother came with deceit and has taken away your blessing." Esau said, "Is he not rightly named Jacob? For he has supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, and now look, he has taken away my blessing." And he said, "Have you not reserved a blessing for me?" Then Isaac answered him and said to Esau, "Indeed, I have made him your master and all his brethren. I have given to him his servants. With grain and wine I have sustained him. What shall I do now for you, my son?" And Esau said to his father, "Have you only one blessing, my father? Bless me, even me also, my father." And Esau lifted up his voice and wept.
Then his father Isaac answered him, "See, away from the fatness of the earth shall your home be, and away from the dew of heaven on high. By your sword you shall live, and you shall serve your brother. And when you break loose, you shall break his yoke from your neck." Now Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said to himself, "The days of mourning for my father are approaching. Then I will kill my brother Jacob." But the words of her son, elder son Esau, were told to Rebekah. So she sent and called her younger son Jacob and said to him, "Your brother Esau is consoling himself by planning to kill you. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice. Flee at once to my brother Laban in Haran, and stay with him a while until your brother's fury turns away. Until your brother's anger turns away, and then he forgets what you have done to him. Then I will send and will bring you back from there. Why should I lose both of you in one day?"
Okay. Rebecca
said to Isaac, "I am weary of my life because of the Hittite women. If Jacob marries one of the Hittite women, such as these, one of the women of the land, what good will my life be to me now?"
All right. Well, this is quite a story. Wow. Maybe instead of just going to what's direction, we'll look at the characters. Let's start with Isaac. What do you observe about Isaac in this story? Yes.
One thing that's always bothered me about Isaac is that he's fooled by Jacob. You know, he knows that the voice is wrong, and that's the one thing that can't be hidden. And yet he lets these little kid skins fool him and accepts. Did he really know that it was Jacob?
Great. Could we have other reaction to that? It's a wonderful question. Yes.
Did Isaac not know about the selling the birthright business?
What do you think?
I think it's the Bible's wonderfully diverse in the
attitude. It
tells two different stories about the same reality.
Okay. What would be maybe, do we find out anything here at all, as I'm going to try to hint at an answer to that question. Do we find out anything at all here about the relationship between Rebecca and Isaac? Are Rebecca and Isaac talking to one another?
No.
The only way Rebecca finds out anything is to listen, you know, to be outside the door listening, or someone else later on reports to her what Esau has said. This would not be, by the way, unusual for a marriage in this sort of patriarchal hierarchy, that the woman would kind of be left out of, it would be a man's world to figure out how the inheritance is going to go and so forth. So there is real strong possibility that Isaac does not know about the oracle that Rebecca received. Yes, Steve.
Question is back to, you talked earlier about the birthright and what that meant.
Yeah.
But this seems to imply the blessing is a separate thing from the birthright.
It is. It's a separate moment from the birthright. The birthright is a legal matter. Okay? The blessing is really passing on the power of the father to whoever is the recipient of the blessing. It was believed that the blessing, you know, the words of the blessing had power to put into motion what the substance of the blessing was. So that's another great question here. What would have happened had Esau received the blessing? Okay, Jacob has the birthright, so he has the legal inheritance of the head of the family. Now what if Esau had received his father's blessing? Can we imagine what might have happened then? You talk about sibling rivalry.
Civil war.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. It ups the ante hugely. If there's already sibling rivalry, actually that's a great way of putting it. There might well have been out-and-out civil war. With one claiming, well, I have the birthright, and the other say, well, wait, so what? I've got my father's final blessing.
And it can go to only one. It can't go to both.
Well, it certainly appears that way here, doesn't it? Yeah. Yeah. Yes, there and then all the way.
It almost makes me wonder if Isaac didn't, in some sense anyway, know that he was giving the blessing to Jacob rather than to Esau, because he's so suspicious. He keeps asking the questions, are you sure, you know, and the voice, and he's comparing the voice and the hair and the smells and everything. I mean, it's not like he assumes that this is Esau. You know, he's very suspicious about the whole thing, and even in his suspicion, he goes ahead and blesses this person who he has doubts about. And you'd think he would have wanted to have just known for sure that that was Esau before he blessed him. But it doesn't seem like he really knows that for sure.
Well, he's suspicious because he hears Jacob's voice instead of Esau's.
Right.
Right. So,
that's what sets up.
So why would you go ahead and do the blessing if you're still suspicious?
It's called hardening of the arteries.
Well, look, I mean, in fairness to Isaac, he does everything he can to try to figure this out, doesn't he? I mean, it's not just one attempt. It's several attempts involving really all the senses. He's blind, but he's not senseless, right? I mean, he can smell.
And feel.
He can feel. He can hear.
Garment was kind of what sent him over like that. Well, it feels right, and I'm getting the food that I usually get from him doesn't sound right. Then when he goes to, I think it's when Jacob leans in to kiss him.
Right.
He smells. Mm-hmm. It smells like he's sung.
Right. Well, I think the text, and then as we read on, Isaac violently trembles when he finds out that there's been a trick here. So I do think there might be a little bit of unclarity, but I think the burden of the text is that he really believes that this is Esau.
Isn't the food different? Because they said they killed two lambs, and wouldn't the food be gamey if he went out to hunt it? If it was Esau's food, wouldn't it be a different food?
I don't know.
Unless
maybe
they use the same spices and covers up the taste of the meat.
Well, Rebecca, after all, made this, so she ought to know, too, what her husband likes.
But
yes.
I think also that all these questions set up Jacob to lie. Apparent. Are you Esau?
Okay.
Yes, I am.
Okay.
And that's repeated. So we see that this is very deliberate and very intentional.
Okay. All right, so let's move. I'm going to move us along just a little bit here from Isaac to Esau. How about Esau?
It really struck me that he says three times, begs his father, bless me also.
Isn't it heartbreaking? Yeah.
Tragedy.
It's a very poignant moment. We really, don't we feel for him? Yes.
Well, my question might be, is Rebecca doing this because she thinks she's following the will of God, or is Rebecca doing this because she simply favors Jacob?
Do we have any evidence of that? I would argue that we do.
Obviously, she and Esau are really alienated.
Well,
yeah.
Notice in.
That doesn't mean she's alienated. Esau.
Notice that in verse 7, Rebecca is now repeating to Jacob what she has overheard her husband Isaac say, right? Except that it's not an exact repetition. There's something a little different in verse 7 from what she has actually overheard. Does anyone catch that? Let's see, in verse 4, then prepare for me savory food such as I like and bring it to me so that I may bless you before I die. Verse 7, her repetition of the same thing. Bring me game and prepare for me savory food to eat that I may bless you before the Lord before I die. She adds the phrase before the Lord. Isn't that interesting? I mean, I think that it, I take that to indicate that she is still focused on this oracle that she received from God.
It's God's will.
It's God's purpose that she's following here. Now, I don't in any way mean to diminish the messiness of all this. I mean, the story, this just gets messier and messier here. I don't mean to diminish that, but I do think that there's an indication that she is really trying to follow what God told her against, again, the conventions of the day. Yeah?
I think my temptation, I think everyone's temptation, is to try and assign blame or responsibility to each of the characters and the decisions they're making, when, in fact, the oracle that Rebecca receives while she's pregnant overdetermines everything that happens. And it's kind of interesting and fun to think, well, is Rebecca doing this because she wants to follow the Lord's will or because she loves Jacob more? When in fact, everything she's feeling, God may have implanted in her for the purpose of bringing everything about. And I don't know what the Jewish understanding of free will here is. But I think that trying to assign blame and responsibility is kind of beside the point.
Well, that's an interesting point, but it's not she's not an automaton, okay? I mean, she has choices here. And all the choices that she makes make it more difficult for her. Okay, notice, what are the consequences of Rebecca's actions here with regard to the rest of her family? Can you imagine them? Pardon me?
Jacob leaves.
She never sees Jacob again after this story.
And she willingly accepts the curse. She tells Jacob, I'll take the curse.
I'm willing to do that. I will accept the curse. Can you imagine Rebecca's relationship with her husband and her other son after this? So, she may be following the oracle, but it's a great consequence for herself. Yes, all the way in the back.
Remember how straightforward the servant was when he went to find the servant, how transparent he was. And for me, that was a real sign that he was actually going to find God's will in that situation. But it's exactly opposite of this coming.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Rebecca and Jacob and the line. Right. Is that the way that you bring an oracle into being?
Is there not an out-and-out lie here? If there were any question that this was completely and utterly deceptive, Isaac asks Jacob at one point, "Are you really my son Esau?" He answered, "I am." Yeah. So this is the question. Is God at work even through out-and-out deception and cunning as well as through the straightforwardness of the servant?
Are these skills that our future leaders have to have?
That's right. Exactly right. This is the future. We are now witnessing the future leader of the people of God.
Because Esau didn't put much value in birthright.
Yeah. Okay.
How much value would he have put in the blessing?
Jacob, if we move on to Jacob, was absolutely aware of what he was doing here, but he was not aware at all of the consequences for him. Okay? A couple of consequences. Getting this blessing, in addition to the birthright, is going to give not so much status and power as responsibility for the spiritual leadership of his people. And that's going to mean that he's going to have to grow spiritually. And the only way he's going to grow spiritually is through great hardship. We're going to see that in the story. He doesn't know that here. He thinks, oh yeah, you know, I'm getting the blessing in addition to the birth. I'm going to come to you in just a moment. Thank you for being patient. The other thing is, Jacob is going to find that what goes around comes around. And we're going to see this maybe tomorrow, certainly by Thursday, that he ends up going to Laban. Laban, well, Jacob proves to be quite a chip off the old block of the family, because Laban is even more of a trickster than Jacob is. So Jacob gets some of his own medicine. Plus, we also see in Genesis Jacob as a father, right? Later on, Jacob has 12 sons. Does Jacob have any favorites?
Yes.
And what happens to Jacob's favorite?
It creates resentment among the other siblings.
It creates resentment among the other siblings, and he gets
sold into slavery,
and as far as Jacob knows, was killed by wild animals. Mm-hmm. So Jacob, you know, seems to be, you know, gets his way here, but his way turns out to be far different than what he thinks. So, but the question raised about, is God at work? Not does God cause, but is God at work even through deception? You know, I think is a great question here, and it raises again the messiness, you know, the messiness of God's work among us. Yes, thank you for being here.
It's a practical question that I would like to ask the cooks here.
Good.
Jacob ordered venison. What he got was goat. And is there a way to make goat taste like venison?
Well, that's what I think.
Yeah, that was your question earlier.
Yeah.
Well, if it's the kidneys.
He said.
If what he favors is the sweet meat.
Oh, okay.
And the goats are eating the same thing that, you know, they're not on pasture land. They're grazing out there in the wilderness, most likely. So the goats are probably eating pretty much the same thing as the deer that, or whatever he's going to bring back. And chances are he's going to eat the organs or whatever, more tasty, more flavor.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know.
Well, I was thinking that if goat tastes different, that might have been one doubt that he had. This doesn't taste like what I ordered.
Could be. Well, just figure that Rebecca knew how to cook so that her husband would
eat.
Would
he like to eat?
Yeah. Okay. Let me raise Terrence Fredheim. I don't know if you know that name.
I do.
Okay.
Who
is Terrence Fredheim?
One of our professors.
He's an
Old Testament professor.
Teaches at Luther Seminary. He has written a commentary on Genesis, and he says this. I think it's quite a striking thing about this story. Fredheim says, God chooses to work in and through what human beings make available. Isn't that a remarkable thing? God chooses to work in and through what human beings make available. In other words, if God had, if he could have written the story and just kind of determined the whole thing, you know, God might have written this story a little bit in a cleaner sort of way. But no. God chooses to work in and through what human beings make available. This reveals a deep divine vulnerability, says Fredheim. I think that's right. For it links God with people whose reputations are not stellar and opens God's ways in the world to sharp criticism. Isn't that right? This reveals a deep divine vulnerability. God is vulnerable enough to work even through human messiness and mixed motives, even outright deception. There's another story that follows in chapter 38. You ought to go back to your rooms or whatever and read chapter 38 if you think this is a messy story. It is the story of Judah and Tamar. Judah is one of Jacob's 12 sons, and there is an institution in the Hebrew society, they're called levirate marriage, that if I have a wife and my wife dies,
If I die,
that's right. Yeah. Thank you very much. If I die, then Then my brother has to have intercourse with my wife in order to bear children and carry on my family line. okay? And the story is very quickly that Tamar was married to one of Judah's sons, and the son died. And Judah, the father, said, "If you think you're bad luck, Tamar, if you think I'm sending giving another son of mine to go in and have a child with you, you've got to be kidding. I value my other son's life more than that." So Tamar, concerned that the inheritance and the lineage would be passed on, disguises herself as a prostitute and has intercourse with Judah, who is the father of her former husband, in order to carry on the family lineage. Talk about a messy story. Huh? And Judah, in the end, says, comes to his senses and says to Tamar, "You're more righteous than I am. I mean, I should have been the one concerned about this, but you've taken it into your own hands to do this." So, I mean, talk about a messy story that God nevertheless is vulnerable enough to work through what human beings make available.
God always works through history and through creation. God never works outside of it, does he?
Okay. Or just kind of pulls the strings, you know, and makes things happen to override our ability to make decisions. This also, you know, in the 100th anniversary of Bonhoeffer's birth, this story here raises some issues about. I mean, Bonhoeffer was very clear that he was, quote, sinning by being involved in a plot to kill Adolf Hitler. I mean, Bonhoeffer, this was not a clear thing for him at all. Being involved in a plot to kill someone.
It was about a lesser evil,
correct.
As he saw it.
Correct.
Whatever he went, it was evil.
That's right.
But this was a lesser evil.
That's exactly right. The overwhelming good of getting Hitler out of the way, you know, even overrode his being involved in what he believed was sinful. So here we have, you know, Rebecca and Jacob involved in some pretty tricky and deceptive stuff. But at least Rebecca believes it's in the furtherance of a greater good. Jacob is completely unconscious to that. And he's going to have to become conscious and grow up spiritually. That's the legacy of this story, and we're going to see that tomorrow beginning to happen in the story of his dream. This is the first time, I'll just give you a tiny preview. From now on, Rebecca is out of the story and Jacob is on his own, and we'll see what happens. He's going to have to grow up, see what happens. So thank you for today.
What was the